Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled Reform or Withdraw: The United States and the Future of the United Nations. Our moderator today is Professor John McGinnis. Professor McGinnis is the George C. Dix Professor in Constitutional Law at Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. He has also served as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. He is the author of Accelerating Democracy, Transforming Government Through Technology, and Originalism and the Good Constitution. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor McGinnis, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Caroline. I'm very pleased to host and speak at this panel today. I want to make clear at the outset that we're really going to be focusing on reform or withdrawing from the agencies of the UN. The UN, of course, mostly in the news, we hear about the General Assembly and the Security Council, but it has a complex structure of agencies that produce international public goods. And the question comes individually whether we should reform or withdraw from some of these agencies. And so that's what we're going to be discussing today. And we're very fortunate to have two great experts on the question. I'll introduce both of them in the order in which they'll speak. And as I say, I will speak a little at the end, and then we'll open it up to you and your questions. First, we're going to hear from Ambassador Grover Joseph Rees. He served as the first United States ambassador to East Timor from 2002 to 2006. From October 2006 and then until January 2009, Ambassador Rees then returned to the State Department and served as the special representative for social issues there. He was responsible for promoting human dignity in particular, including issues affecting vulnerable persons and the family. He served further as acting U.S. representative to the United States Economic and Social Council during the fall 2007 session of the UN General Assembly, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Organizations. From 1995 until 2002, Ambassador Rees was a senior staff member on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the United States House of Representatives. And there he played a major role in drafting and enacting important human rights provisions. Ambassador Rees has also formerly served in a wide variety of posts in the executive branch: General Counsel of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service, and Special Counsel to the Attorney General of the United States. He also has served in the judicial branch, although quite far away, in America, Samoa. And prior to his varied work in Washington, in Samoa, and East Timor, Ambassador Rees was a law professor at the University of Texas. We'll then hear from Peter Yu, Senior Vice President, UN Foundation, and President of the Better World Campaign. One of the nation's leading experts on U.S. and U.N. affairs. Peter leads the Better World Campaign strategic engagement with Congress, the administration, and organizations supporting stronger American leadership on the world stage. He's helped advance critical legislation in U.S. Congress to ensure the country meets its obligations to the United Nations. He first joined the Better World Campaign in 2009 with 20 years of legislative, analytic, and management experience, including senior roles on Capitol Hill and the State Department. Prior to arriving at the UN Foundation, he spent a decade as deputy staff director on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, where he worked on a broad range of foreign policy and foreign aid issues. Prior to that work, He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. State Department, where he successfully advocated for the repayment of U.S. arrears to the U.N. He was part of the important U.S. delegation to the climate negotiations in Kyoto. With that, I'll introduce and ask Professor or Ambassador Reese now to speak. I'm afraid you're still muted.
You're still muted, Grover.
Just a moment. Okay, there we go.
There we go.
Thank you so much, John, and thanks so much to Peter for his participation as well. When I think about the dichotomy that we've put as the topic of this seminar webinar, I'm reminded of the, which is, do we withdraw from these organizations, stop supporting them, or do we reform them? Do we try to reform them? I'm reminded of the Peanuts cartoon about the little boy who wanted to kick the football. And the girl, Lucy, is always holding the football. She says, "This time I promise I will let you kick the football." And of course, she always moves it right before he kicks it. And there are various embellishments on that theme. There's a difference, though, in terms of our efforts over the years at UN Reform, which is if you read carefully, the other parties who would be necessary for reform don't even promise that they're going to keep holding the football. They're pretty clear that there really is a fundamental difference in views, and that's what sometimes our diplomats don't recognize, that we're not, the things we don't like about the various United Nations organizations are not regarded by others as a bug. They're regarded as a feature, and it's an important feature. Of course, everybody's a fiscal conservative, at least at election time, and you can get people on board. Certainly some of the Western powers will be on board that the UN spends too much money, some of it in wasteful ways. But the problem is that every body of the United Nations, even technically including the Security Council, reports to the General Assembly. And the General Assembly is dominated by groups who are fundamentally opposed to most of what we're for. And I mean that on substance, and I mean that on procedure. The idea that there should be all these sinecures, that there should be all these offices, which we regard as waste, fraud, and abuse, is regarded as a very small step toward redressing the evils of colonialism by many people in the United Nations. And if you read United Nations resolutions, including those that are supposed to be about human rights, you would think that the biggest human rights violation in the world today is the vestiges of colonialism. They think that the problems in the world are very different than we think the problems in the world are. So even on matters like, should we have all these jobs where the people really don't do very much and aren't qualified for their jobs, is seen as neocolonialism when we say it. On substance, I read up a little bit on this because I wasn't quite sure why we had withdrawn from UNESCO. I knew there were a lot of possible reasons, but I wanted to make sure I got it right. And in 2017, when we were about to withdraw from UNESCO, there was a study that showed that since 2009, there had been 16 resolutions by UNESCO criticizing particular countries. Nine of them were about Israel. Four of them were about Crimea. And two of them were about Syria, and there were no others from about any other countries, nothing about China, nothing about Burma, nothing about North Korea. So the question is, when we try to say, okay, let's reform UNESCO, how are we going to reform it? How are we going to convince? What arguments are we going to use other than we're the biggest donor and we won't pay unless you do reform? So, yeah, they'll agree to some kind of reform. But the reforms aren't going to work. The reforms not only are not going to make things better, they're often going to make things worse. And the outstanding the outstanding point on this was in 2005, when there had been a lot of dissatisfaction, not only in the United States, but in human rights advocates around the world with the UN Human Rights Commission, which had a very proud history, but for the past 15 or 20 years, you couldn't get a resolution passed on human rights violations in Cuba, or very rarely. You couldn't get one passed about human rights violations in China. Indeed, these countries were on the Human Rights Commission, Cuba, China, Burma, Libya. So we decided there should be reform, and we invested a lot of diplomacy into this, and we got agreement that there should be reform. And one of the reforms was they elevated it from a commission to a council. So before that, there were only two councils, National Security Council and Economic and Social Council. Now there's a Human Rights Council. Well, one of the things that did is it changed the voting formula for electing members. And the voting formula was even worse. You were even more guaranteed. Wei Jingsheng, the human rights advocate from China, had called the Human Rights Commission a club of tyrants. You were even more guaranteed to get a club of tyrants. And so the United States responded that by withdrawing from the Human Rights Council, and we've been on it and off it. Generally off it in Republican administrations and on it in Democratic administrations. And that brings me to my second point. Just because most of these organizations are most of the time going to do things we don't like doesn't necessarily mean we should withdraw from them, even though we're not going to be able to reform them. And I think about the test I use for whether I should go to a meeting. It's not whether I think it's going to be a great meeting. It's whether I think things will be a lot worse if I don't go. And it seems to me that should be the test for whether we withdraw from a UN agency. If we withdraw, we won't be there. Some countries that are like-minded with us on some issues will still be there and will still be able to carry the ball, but they don't carry it very aggressively. And so almost certainly these organizations will do even more things and even worse things that we don't like if we withdraw. So that is an argument for staying in and doing what we can, even though we know that because of the fundamental structural problems, most of the time we're going to lose. But that brings me to the third point. Sometimes what they do is just so egregious that you got to do something. And that something usually means withdrawing support or withdrawing membership. And I think of two examples of this. One of them was the UN Population Fund, PA. Which during the time when it was beginning to be widely known that there were forced abortions and forced sterilizations that were not occasional abuses, but central to the working of the Chinese Family Planning Organization, UNFPA gave them more than one award and gave the head of it, Peng Peiyang, the head of the Chinese program. She was the acting chairman at the beginning of the Women's Conference in Beijing. They gave her all kinds of honors. So the United States stopped supporting UNFPA. We took the $35 million, which is what it was at the time, and we spent it on our own initiatives on family planning and on related issues. And the second is the UNRWA, UNRWA, Refugee Works Agency, and it's got to do with Palestinian refugees who are basically defined as the descendants by, in whatever degree, of the people who are the Palestinians who were displaced in 1948. And they, UNRWA, you know, there's been a laundry list. Most recently, it's that a number of their employees, maybe a small number, maybe a larger number, actually participated in the October 7th massacre in Israel. But before that, it's, you know, they fund textbooks that refer to Israel as the Zionist entity or don't have it on the map at all. They've been quite clearly in a camp that we can't support, and so we've still generally supported them. But President Trump has withdrawn support, I think, now a second time. So those are the two outstanding examples. There are just some things that we can't sit by and say, "Well, it'll be even worse if we don't do it." So that would be the structure that I would suggest for decision making on these matters.
Peter.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for asking me to join this important panel today. And nice to see my longtime friend and colleague, Ambassador Reese. So listen, at the Better World Campaign, our job is to work with the U.S., and other countries to, we're basically trying to make the case that U.S. involvement in the United Nations serves American interests. And we are big believers in a far-reaching and focused reform agenda at the United Nations. And in fact, really the significant reforms that have occurred at the United Nations over the past decade in terms of how it's run, how it's managed, and how it tackles controversial issues really does show that major reform is possible, particularly when America is at the table. And what's also exciting is that the effort to push for reform and the effort to stay in the United Nations and lead is supported by the American people. A poll that was conducted by Morning Consult last summer showed that 75% of Americans wanted the U.S. to remain engaged in the United Nations, including 65% of Republicans. So from our perspective, that's a withdraw or don't withdraw question, and the American public clearly wants to stay and fight. So listen, this topic is quite timely of reform or withdraw. Legislation is introduced every 2 years in the U.S. Congress to withdraw from the United Nations, and it's been introduced once again. And for the first time in American history, and since the creation of the United Nations, over the past 2 years, the House of Representatives has voted as part of its annual appropriations process to fully defund the UN regular budget and almost all other UN agencies' funds and programs. So it's not just an academic debate. It's an issue that is being actively considered by the U.S. Congress. And of course, the new administration has taken significant actions to withdraw or defund certain, though not all, UN programs. The president has indicated his belief that UN has great promise. I just want to make 4 points to sort of begin this consideration. First of all, meaningful UN reform is possible. Over the past several years, really with strong pushes from the Trump administration and the Biden administration, we've seen the entire restructuring of the UN development system to reduce inefficiencies and to ensure better outcomes. We've seen a significantly closer alignment between UN peacekeeping operations and UN efforts designed to prevent conflict from beginning at all. We've seen a reduced budget for UN peacekeeping and demonstrably greater transparency as it relates to sexual exploitation and abuse in UN peacekeeping missions. Furthermore, the Secretary General just launched a UN at 80 initiative designed to reduce UN mandates, immediately implement additional efficiencies, and review the structure of the organization. So this is not your father's UN. This is not your grandfather's UN. This is a changing UN. And it's not just the U.S. that's pushing for this. Other major donor countries are pushing and achieving significant reforms, not just in New York, but across the swath of UN agencies, funds, and programs. So first of all, reform is possible. It's happening. Second of all, withdrawing from the UN, as Ambassador Reese made this point, it just leaves the organization to other countries that don't share our values, particularly China and Russia. As the Chinese economy continues to grow, along with their vision for China's role in the world, they pay more of the UN's bills, consistent with rules that the U.S. has always supported in terms of how we charge countries for assessed contributions to the UN. And with additional financial contributions, they've gained additional leverage in advancing their agenda at the United Nations. Of course, both China and Russia have vetoes in the Security Council. If the U.S. were to leave the UN, the organization doesn't go away. Rather, 193 other UN member states would likely remain in the organization, but countries that don't share American values on rule of law and democracy and good governance would have greater sway in the organization. Third, American investments in the UN are absolutely in our nation's interest. The UN Security Council is the only global entity that can impose international sanctions, such as those exist against North Korea, and actually has the capacity to work with countries to enforce those sanctions. The UN's World Health Organization is the only organization positioned to detect pandemics before they hit American shores, and most importantly, to quickly bring together the scientific community around vaccines and treatment. And when humanitarian disasters strike, whether they're caused by man-made conflict or whether they're caused by natural disaster, the UN is uniquely positioned to act quickly and make sure that people are fed, educated, and have shelter. And the UN Office of Drugs and Crime is on the front lines of fighting fentanyl and the importation of precursor chemicals into the United States. So this is an example, but it is a long list of UN agency funds and programs absolutely serving American foreign policy and national security interests. And fourth, you know, participation in the UN serves American economic interests. The U.S. was the largest supplier of goods and services to the United Nations in 2023. The $2.2 billion that are invested in U.S. Businesses each year exceeds America's assessed dues to the UN's regular budget and to UN peacekeeping. So, listen, I'm an advocate for the UN, you can clearly tell, but I understand the long list of frustrations with the United Nations. UN member states do use the UN to disproportionately focus on Israel. Despite its important accomplishments, the UN Human Rights Council continues to have members who do not respect human rights. They do, of course, over the past 5 years, have passed important measures related to Syria, North Korea, freedom of assembly, Ukraine, other important issues that are directly aligned with American interests. So they don't always speak up on every issue that matters to the U.S., but they speak up on a lot. And I think we need to recognize that the Human Rights Council, it is not a black or white equation. It's complex. And the UN Relief and Works Agency, as has been discussed, is also an area of significant controversy. So I get that there are areas of contention and will continue to be. But the answer to all of this is to stay. With its veto in the UN Security Council, its status as the largest financial contributor to the UN, and the fact that the UN Charter and its work absolutely reflects American values and American footprint, we're better off showing leadership rather than slinking away into a corner. The Trump administration is sending our best and brightest to represent our interests in New York, Representative Elise Stefanik, and I am confident that she has the stature and diplomatic skills and the coalition building required for major UN reform and change. So why don't I leave it right there and turn it back to you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. So may I encourage those in the audience now to begin formulating questions. I'm going to give a few remarks, and then we're going to get to your questions. And I want to give an overview of why, first of all, I think America is the indispensable nation for improving the performance of UN agencies. And second, I'd like to describe why I think at this moment it's possible that threatening to leave certain agencies in certain circumstances might be a method for catalyzing improvement. It's credible, perhaps in a way that it hasn't always been before. I begin with the premise that the United States plays a role like no other nation in making sure that international organizations produce the international public goods that they are supposed to produce. Because let's be clear, the only reason to have UN agencies or other multilateral organizations is that they can produce goods that cannot be better produced at the national level or by the market. That's a basic principle of subsidiarity. It's exemplified, of course, by the federalism that we enjoy in the United States. But the international production of public goods has pathologies that national production does not have. The parties to the agreement are nations, and we lack coercive force, either civil or criminal, to make sure that the national actors or the bureaucrats they appoint will actually produce the public goods. Instead, they may rip off our taxpayers or even produce public bads, the opposite of what the agency is supposed to do. Indeed, most nations have incentives to use the agency for their own national ends rather than to produce public goods. They may gain a little from the optimal production of the international public good, but being a small nation or one of many nations, will gain even more for themselves if they can chisel some things for themselves than they will lose from the international public good. This is, of course, particularly true of authoritarian nations where the chiseling can benefit a few leaders. And thus, while I fully agree with Ambassador Reese that one of our problems is there's some disagreement on the objectives of the agencies, I think there's also a structural problem with international public goods that indeed may lead some countries to use disagreement as a facade for their interest, their interest, which is in using the agency for their own national ends rather than the international public goods for which it was established. I think the United States is in a pretty different position. Because it has such a large share of the GDP of the world, it very disproportionately benefits from the public goods that UN agencies produce that facilitate peace and prosperity. For instance, avoiding pandemics helps everyone, but particularly the United States, given the high cost of disruption here. The diffusion of human rights ultimately makes nations more peaceful. And again, that's very useful to the United States as the world's hegemon. Thus, the United States is the likeliest nation to make sure that UN agencies stay on track. In this sense, paradoxically, an American first agenda is likely a world first agenda. Thus, an American first agenda, for instance, would demand clear, measurable benefits and withdraw or reduce support when agencies are inefficient, corrupt. It's in the world's interest, of course, to have these efficiencies. It's also going to try to make sure the agency is actually producing an international public good, despite the structural pathologies that I've outlined, that benefits the world as well as America. And United States leadership is particularly important because international organizations have trouble staying on track for an additional reason. Your bureaucracies cannot be easily controlled. It's well understood in the political science literature that organizations with multiple principles, and of course, the United Nations agencies have many nations as their principals, have trouble managing their agents. But if one principal can exert more leverage, he may bring the agents more into alignment with the focus of the mission of the agency, closer to the case where there's only one or a small number of principals. I think the U.S. Can be, at least in some circumstances, that principal. Thus, it's not a surprise, I think, the United States has long been the best advocate for good governance for UN agencies, pushing, for instance, for greater transparency and often for proposals like individual inspector generals in the agencies. It's also naturally the greatest opponent of nations that want to turn a UN agency like that on human rights to an agency for the perpetuation of human wrongs. On the question of whether to withdraw reform, I think we, in some cases, may need to threaten to withdraw in order to reform. I understand that's not always worked in the past, but the United States, I do think, has an advantage today. The president is Donald Trump, and he has a credibility in delivering shocks to the established order. For instance, to look at another multilateral agency, not an international agency, he seems to have gotten Europe, in particular Germany, to dramatically increase its defense budget. Past presidents have been, I think it's fair to say, more establishment-oriented than our current president. And that gives us a certain freedom of action and credibility. And the United States, as in other nations, one difficulty, I think, with making credible threats in the international forum is that an ecosystem develops around UN agencies, such as NGOs, whose work and very existence is facilitated by the continued operation of these agencies. And that ecosystem tries to understandably protect these agencies. And therefore, the establishment in the United States reduces the credibility of threats. But I think it's fair to say that the current president owes nothing to the establishment. Thus, I think at this moment, and of course, it will depend how we want to use this leverage on a careful investigation of the particular circumstances of the agencies and what they're doing, as Ambassador Reese has suggested. But I do think we have our best opportunity to put the leverage of the indispensable nation to make real change at UN agencies. Thanks very much, and I'll look for some questions now. The first question comes up. What things are genuinely changeable at the UN, consistent with its charter of promoting peace and reducing conflict? So why don't I begin with that? There's some other questions as well, but I'll get to those. Well, what things are genuinely changeable at the UN, consistent with its charter promoting peace and reducing conflict? Why don't I begin with you, Peter?
Several things, which is, first of all, one of the upsides of the significant funding reductions that have occurred, not just from the U.S., but from our European allies as part of the overall contraction of foreign aid, is that it forces UN agencies to run their programs more efficiently and to make tough choices. And so I think UN agencies are capable of running their programs more efficiently. I believe that with the leadership of UN member states, they're need to make tough decisions about the structure of the organization, and most importantly, what the UN is going to do and what it's not going to do. The UN, works in almost every country around the world, and at some point we'll have to make difficult decisions about where it works and the extent to which it works in certain countries. So I would say the scope of the programs, the mandate of the programs, I also feel that, on the human rights front, when the U.S. is in the Human Rights Council, which it is not at the moment, but also when it's in other UN bodies, the track record in terms of the human rights statements, human rights resolutions being consistent with American interests goes up significantly. And when the U.S. is not at the table, we find that on the human rights front, it is less consistent. So American leadership at the UN is absolutely effective and advancing our interests.
So, yes, please. I was going to ask you, and because of course you've had some experience and Joseph, what is changeable and what might not be at the UN?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I'm not anything like the expert that Peter is on these things. For the last 10 years, you're right, it might as well be my grandfather's UN that I'm talking about. I have not kept up with things on the granular level that I used to. But I think sometimes things can be dressed up as reforms as you say, John, are not only not leading to more public goods, they're leading to public bads. And I can think of two things. When I was still in government, when I was ambassador to East Timor, one of the reforms to make things more efficient, more streamlined, less duplication, was the concept of one UN. And one UN meant that instead of having UNICEF and UNESCO and World Health Organization and UNDP all doing their own thing in each country, they'd have to coordinate. There'd be a UN coordinator, and that person would pretty much tell which agency what they were going to do. Well, that one UN turned out to be UNDP. UN Development Program in most places. That turned out to be the coordinator. And of all the different agencies, the one that in the development area, UNDP was the worst from our standpoint. It was the least efficient. It was the most willing to work with authoritarian regimes and, you know, build highways to places the Burmese army wanted to go and things like that. So it weakened the agencies that we would have been more willing to support if there could be many UNs instead of one. And the second one was in 2015, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees announced what they called a global recalibration. By the way, very, very strongly supported by our bureaucracy on refugees within the State Department and the Population, Refugees, and Migration Bureau. And basically they said, resettlement of refugees is going to be a distant third choice to other durable solutions. We'll recognize people as refugees, but don't expect that you're going to be resettled in the United States. Well, that was already the rule. It was already the third choice. The first choices were local integration in the country, first asylum, or safe and voluntary repatriation. But the reality is that those two things are often impossible, and there are a lot of refugees who need to be resettled. I have been working with a legal clinic in Bangkok since that time. And we saw the number of people who were stranded with miserable lives in Bangkok go up by 20-fold, 30-fold. Now, that was seen as a reform because people in the refugee business see resettlement as a magnet for more people to come. And that's probably true. It's just not the only principle, the only desideratum that matters. I'm sure there are other reforms that worked better than that. But just because something is called a reform, and just because the people in the United States government who are most directly involved support it, doesn't mean that every American should support it.
So another question, which goes more to the Security Council, has been asked, is the failure of the U.S. General Assembly to address remedy Russia's invasion of Ukraine proof that it really is not capable of compelling its members to avoid armed conflicts or invasions? Peter?
Sure. Well, just a comment on the previous question. I agree with you on your first point about the resident coordinator system. That's why one of the important reforms that's happened over the past 5 years is that UNDP no longer automatically has the resident coordinator system, and there's a new independent resident coordinator system in every country in which independent people are brought in to coordinate all of the UN's work. So they listened, and the reform has happened, and I've seen it in action in many countries around the world, and it's very impressive what they've been able to accomplish by moving to an independent resident coordinator system. I would just note on the Russia invasion of Ukraine, of course, that it was the UN General Assembly that brought the world together in opposition to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It was not the Security Council because of the Russian veto. It was not the US going around capital to capital together with the Europeans. It was the General Assembly, where over 140 countries voted, not once but twice, to oppose the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So in fact, the when you think about the international sanctions that were imposed upon Russia after the invasion, you think about the fairly unanimous work by countries around the world to indicate their opposition. All of that coalition was developed in New York in the General Assembly. Of course, as we think about peace and security issues in the future, you know, if it affects one of the P5 members of the UN Security Council, the ability of the UN and the Security Council to resolve the issue is going to be more limited, including if it affects the United States. So we just need to recognize that the veto power of the P5 countries does limit the ability of the UN to tackle these types of issues when one of the P5 members is an active combatant.
And paradoxically, the veto in the Security Council is the overarching reason why the United States should not withdraw from the United Nations. I mean, if there were no other good thing about the United Nations, the fact that we've got a veto in the Security Council, and while Russia does too, China does too, you know, there are different philosophies about within the government, as you probably know, Peter, about whether we should propose resolutions that we know are going to be vetoed by Russia or China. And in the second Bush administration, my boss, Assistant Secretary Kristen Silverberg, said, why the heck not? You know, let's make them do in broad daylight what they would like to do in darkness. And it didn't make everybody happy within the State Department, but including some of our people in New York. But we did. We had resolutions on Burma, on Zimbabwe, on Sudan that were vetoed by Russia and China. And then that on some, we got the majority of the 15 votes in the Security Council. On a couple, I think we didn't. But at least you knew who was who. You created a record. I think we should do more of that. And I hope our Ambassador Stefanik will revive that tradition.
I think that answer underscores something I mentioned at the beginning of our panel. I don't think anyone here is thinking it wise to withdraw from the United Nations as a whole. What is a more complicated question is the United Nations now has many different agencies, and we have withdrawn on occasion from some of them when they seem to be producing worse results for the United States than we can tolerate. The question is, when under what circumstances is that plausible, and what circumstances does our exit threats become credible? Those, I think, are the hard questions that necessarily depend on circumstances. The idea that we'll just leave the United Nations seems quite one that may get some sound bites on talk shows, but does not seem to be a sensible or even plausible part of U.S. Foreign policy. So one final question we've gotten from this from here is, well, is the United Nations, therefore, if it can't settle these disputes, is it really no different from the League of Nations, which was famously rather ineffective and retired after World War II. Anyone want to take a crack at that?
Well, I think, again, looking at this and from a black and white perspective is not terribly productive. Even on the Ukraine situation, the Secretary General played a very important role in negotiating the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which was quite helpful for over a year in terms of ensuring that Ukrainian wheat could continue to be exported. So, again, it's not an issue about whether it stops conflict or not. It does. There's peacekeeping missions in over 11 countries that play an active role in protecting civilians from being slaughtered each and every day. I've been to almost every UN peacekeeping mission. They play also a very important role in reducing conflict and preventing situations from dramatically worsening in cases like Cyprus, ensuring that combatant or parties don't inadvertently trip their way into war. So there's plenty of instances where the UN plays a very important role in reducing conflict. And in fact, in many of these cases, the UN's chief diplomat, in essence, the head of the political department, is always an American. And she plays a very important role behind the scenes, getting parties to negotiate so that they don't move forward with conflict. And in those cases, the UN does not send out big press releases, give themselves a lot of credit, because the parties deserve the credit and need the credit in order to embrace the peace and embrace the solution. So the UN's working every day behind the scenes and above the fold to try to promote peace and security. It's more complex than if you didn't stop the war in Russia, then the UN's not worth anything. It's a more complex issue.
So there's a question here that it goes to an issue that I raised, so I'd love to have the other participants weigh in on it. The question of the UN bureaucracy. I suggested that because actually of multiple principles, there's theoretical literature that suggests it's very hard to control bureaucrats. And one of our members of the audience asked, having served as a public delegate with the U.S. delegation on the UN's main human rights body and tried to work with it from outside as a USCIRF commissioner, I observed the staff bureaucrats of the UN act at the behest of large malign actors day and night. They undermine reforms and initiatives that China and Russia oppose. What can be done to overhaul its staff?
Well, first, this is my opportunity to say that even though I've come across as the relative hardliner in this panel, although I think that some talk show hosts would still think I'm a squish and a rhino. I want to make clear that you know, not everybody in the United Nations is bad. There are some really wonderful people, some excellent public servants, and I have several in mind, people I met in East Timor, people I met in New York. I greatly admire the president, the current Secretary General. I think he did a wonderful job as United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and I think he's doing as good a job as anybody could do in his current job. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There, when I was working in the UN in 2007, there, you know, China is entitled in the unspoken formula to at least one Undersecretary General, and I was required by some protocol to have lunch with this Undersecretary General, whose name I've blessedly forgotten. But boy, was he terrible! I mean, he wasn't one of the ones who went to Harvard on a U.S. exchange program and was good at schmoozing. All he wanted to talk about was Japan and everything we should do to Japan. He was unreconstructed. And Russia had people like that, too. I mean, in the General Assembly, there was a resolution by Russia that passed once because people didn't read it on xenophobia and racism and Nazism. And it turned out that one of the instances of xenophobia was if you tear down historical monuments, i.e. Statues of Stalin and Lenin. So there are people in the United Nations, people with United Nations jobs. I don't know the exact details on this, but the division in the United Nations that's in charge of the occupied territories in Palestine is larger than that for some continents. And those people are part of the problem in terms of the United Nations being anti-Israel. So all those problems are real. That was my starting point. As Peter has pointed out, we can make even those things at least a little better at the margins by persisting. But the problems are not going to go away because the majority of the 193 countries support these aspects of the United Nations.
I would just note that, I mean, the U.S. is part of the problem here. Under Democratic and Republican administrations, the U.S. has insisted that, that this post is American, that post is American, this post is American, this post goes to the French person, this person goes to the British person. And so when we create a system and support a system that has country allocations for particular jobs, it's exact opposite of hiring the most qualified person for a particular position. And so we ourselves need to look at our own positions and say, maybe we should support a thorough and far-reaching reform of the UN system to ensure that this sort of country allocation process that sometimes exists doesn't happen. I would just also note that, you know, of course there are people within the UN system that don't share our values. I, again, have met thousands of UN employees and in my travels over the last 15 years and have been struck by their dedication and their commitment to human rights and democracy. When you go to these small villages, small towns, small cities in Africa and meet with UN workers working far from home, they are committed to alleviating poverty, to promoting human rights, promoting elections, promoting freedom, and they're paying the cost. 15, 20 years ago, UN workers were not considered a legitimate target for terrorists. They are now. And so as a result, people working for the UN are being targeted and killed far from their homes, trying to work to promote greater peace and stability. So I think, you know, it's a mistake to characterize all UN employees as one way or another as a bunch of faceless bureaucrats who hate America and love China and Russia. That's false.
But you know, Peter, on the country allocation principle, yeah, not only is it bad because it guarantees China and Russia and others some people, yeah, the Americans, there's also an informal veto over who the American would be. So when I was there, they replaced the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, who by tradition always has to be an American. And the man they chose, a wonderful man, friend of mine, but squishiest guy I knew on questions relating to China. you know, and because, and he was picked, I think, partly because it had to be somebody acceptable to the government of China.
So let me just jump in just for a second. I don't want to seem less hard line than Joseph, because I really think this is a really serious issue. I would first of all say that I'm a little cautious about equating U.S. with other countries. I do think even if the U.S. appoints people, they're likely to act more in the world interest than other nations. I understand that maybe a hard sell at an international body. But I think it's important to keep in mind that the United States, as a because of its peculiar position in the world, is likely to represent the encompassing interests of the world. And we should really push for our interests in that respect. With respect to the usual bureaucrats at the UN, I think it's not only a question of some of these very high-level people at the UN, but how jobs are allocated on the basis of nationality rather than competence. And secondly, how sometimes, as I understand it, the bureaucrats at the United Nations may still have fundamental allegiance to their own country that is enforced by even coercion. And I think there really could be kinds of reforms to address that kind of problem, or I think it certainly is one that we certainly should try to do, again, maybe beginning with some of these smaller agencies where the U.S. may have great leverage because of its funding. And maybe that could be a kind of model for the United Nations as a whole. So I do think this is a very important issue of the bureaucracy. The way public goods are produced is in no small measure a consequence of the personnel that produce them. And the pathologies that we've heard described, I think, are a substantial obstacle to that. And so we should think about how the U.S. can use its leverage to make these kind of structural reforms. There's one other point I would make about this opportunity that I do think we have with the current president and his credibility is the reform should be structural. They shouldn't be just a kind of one-time off. They should try to change the structure of the UN, because that can change, I think, a culture of an organization and can make some enduring improvements. So we have one other question here, which is a little with respect to the Security Council, why not remove Russia from the Security Council, invoking Rule 17 of the procedural rules that cannot be vetoed? This is someone who knows a lot about the technical rules of the UN. Maybe I'll give this one to Peter to have a crack at. I can think of some real politique reasons why we can't get rid of Russia. But what if we're a legal formalist? Does Rule 17 allow us to kick Russia off from or remove its veto power?
The answer is, I don't know. So I'm afraid I'm not schooled in that particular provision. And I can give you a real politique answer as well. And I don't think China, of course, would support that either. And they have a veto. So it's a little bit more complex. But again, I'm not sure I have the answer. I'm sorry.
But it underscores, I think the limits of whatever Rule 17 says, there are limits of formalism in international affairs. The reason, and I just don't think it's a plausible approach to kick Russia out of the UN at the moment.
Well, and now that the U.S. is normalizing relations with Russia and the war is ending in Ukraine, and it seems like the moment for that is perhaps come and gone in terms of an American perspective as well. And of course, the Chinese wouldn't be amenable to it. So, yeah, but this is on my Google list, is to better
understand. The General Assembly would not be amenable to it. Never mind. I mean, you know, there are countries who probably oppose Russia, who don't like Russia, who don't like what it's doing, but they won't. One of the principles that comes up anytime you talk about criticizing a country in the General Assembly is, oh, there you go again, naming and shaming. And the only, but they're perfectly willing to name and shame Israel, to name and shame the United States. Anybody else, it's the principle of naming and shaming is wrong. When we first started paying attention to the Uyghurs, who were not in nearly as much trouble as they are now, we thought, this is great. We can go to these countries like Saudi Arabia that usually oppose human rights resolutions, and because these are fellow Muslims being severely persecuted, they'll vote for us with us on the China resolution. Nope. Their overarching principle was non-interference in internal affairs. So the General Assembly wouldn't support it. As for technically whether Rule 17 would allow it, you know, I have to admit I've been spending so much time trying to remember what Article 2 of the Constitution says that my detailed knowledge of Rule 17 of the United Nations Charter has just evaporated. So I'll have to look that one up.
Well, we have time for one more question, which is also on the veto power. Can you foresee a time when the Security Council veto power is expanded or restricted as we move farther away from post-World War II order? I mean, I should mention that there have been proposals to have more countries have veto power to reflect the growing power of countries of regions of Africa and Latin America. So there actually have been proposals to expand the veto power.
Germany, Brazil, and South Africa are the ones I remember. India, but that's part of the problem. Is once you start talking about how to expand it, everybody gets to play.
And the more veto points, this is also
my friend John Bolton, probably not in public, but in personal conversation, whenever Germany came up in that context, he'd say, "Oh yes, permanent member of the General Assembly."
Well, and political science is very clear on this. The more veto points you have in an organization, the less it will get done. So that would be a consequence, I think, of adding more. So I don't know if have there been any proposals to restrict. Maybe I'll go to you, Peter, because there certainly have been ones to expand it, to restrict the veto power in the Security Council.
There has been more discussions in New York about expansion of the Security Council over the past 2 years. Ambassador Thomas Greenfield moved forward with the proposal, which he actually announced at an event that I hosted for the U.S. mission out in San Francisco, where the UN Charter was signed. But her proposal was focused on adding in additional non-veto wielding members of the Security Council. So it was designed to sort of address this issue of how do you bring in more representation from Africa and Latin America and Asia, but not gum up the works by additional vetoes. There have been no serious proposals that have been considered that would give new members of the Security Council vetoes, nor have there been any serious proposals considered that would eliminate the vetoes of the P5 members. There's periodically a discussion that, and this did happen actually, that if a member vetoes something in Security Council, it triggers a General Assembly debate about that veto. So that has occurred. And there was, it's not an unreasonable proposal that if you veto something, you should explain it. And so the world has kept spinning, even as countries have periodically had to explain their vetoes to the General Assembly. But that's really the only reform that's occurred.
Well, the magnetic north has shifted.
Yeah.
Well, with that, I think we should thank our panelists and for this very learned discussion. And we're very grateful to the Federalist Society for entertaining it.
Thank you so much, Professor McGinnis. Yes, just wanting to echo you on behalf of the Federalist Society. I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.